This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pianist Fred Hirsch has a new recording of If I Loved You, which reminded me of what a beautiful song it is. We'll hear it in a moment. The song is featured on Hirsch's new solo album, recorded live at Maybeck Recital Hall. His previous trio album, Dancing in the Dark, was nominated for a Grammy. This is a busy season for Hirsch, with his work represented on 7 new and forthcoming CDs. Several of them are to benefit people with AIDS and AIDS research. Hirsch learned he was HIV positive in 1986. It's only recently that he's been public about that. He's asymptomatic and very active as a performer, composer, and producer. Before pursuing his solo career, he played with such well-known musicians as Stan Getz, Art Farmer, and Joe Henderson. Let's get started with If I Loved You from Fred Hirsch's new recording, Fred Hirsch at Maybeck.
There's certain traps to avoid in general when you're improvising music. Over the years, I've gotten to work as a sideman with people that I really consider to be masters, and a few people that have given me a couple of like kernels of wisdom that have really helped me, which I pass then along to all the students that I work with. I can remember. The very first record I made with Art Farmer as a sideman in around 1979, which would have been for Concord Jazz, I think, and I was trying so hard. I wanted it to be so perfect and so great, and I wanted, you know, and Art took me aside in a very kind of fatherly way. He said, you know, all you can do when you're recording or when you're playing a solo is just try to make sense from phrase to phrase, like a conversation. And for some reason, that was like just the right thing to hear at just the right time. So that's one of the things that you probably should avoid as an improviser is just trying too hard or having an agenda, wanting to play a lot of fast stuff or wanting to impress somebody or impress a critic or wanting to play kind of far out, rather than just playing whatever is going on at the moment. Hearing it, letting it affect what you play next, and letting the whole thing unfold. That's what I like about a ballad, is, you know, just the pace of allowing it to unfold.
You mentioned that nice analogy that Art Farmer gave you, that about, you know, playing should be like a conversation where one phrase naturally
falls another. Yeah, just let it unfold.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your new album, it's solo at Maybeck Recital Hall, so of course you can't really be having a conversation in that respect.
Right.
It's more like a monologue, but you don't want it to sound like a speech.
Right.
Is it hard to play solo?
Well, actually, I enjoy playing solo. I use a lot of, you know, a lot of left-hand stuff and counterpoint inner voices, and those and that stuff comes out really nicely, obviously, when you're playing by yourself. But you did hit on something, that the important thing is to not make it into, like, a presentation, like, here's a bunch of stuff that I learned how to play, and now I'm just going to kind of lay it on you. So what I did on this particular recording is probably at least, of the ones that ended up on the tape, on the CD, probably three or four I had never really performed before at all, including If I Loved You. I just figured that way I can surprise myself. I announce to the audience, hey, I'm going to play some things that I know very well, and I'm going to play some things that I don't know at all, and let's see what happens. So I was kind of reading, sight reading, more or less, with very little preparation. That way I knew those things would be fresh and I would be involved in them. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
Sounds risky to me.
Yeah, well, it's I prefer to operate that way. For me, I'd rather sometimes the first few times I play something, it's the freshest, and then it gets a little more contrived, or I start to compete with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I record with a trio, what we do is rather than record one song over and over till we get it right, we record in sets. So we'll put together a set of three or four songs, just like we're playing in a club. Then we'll take a break, then we'll do three or four more songs, and we'll just do a whole bunch of different sets without worrying about, you know, what comes out, what we like or what we don't like until the dust settles. And so with a solo concert, I just had this list of tunes, and I just decided at the spur of the moment which tune I would play and what I would do with it. And it kept it, for me, it kept me from getting, nervous or predictable.
You have been working on several albums to benefit AIDS, and in a minute I want to play a really beautiful song that you wrote that's featured on one of these forthcoming records. It's from the AIDS Quilt songbook. The song is called Blues for an Imaginary Valentine. Is there a story behind writing the song?
Yeah, there is, actually. I had met William Parker, who was the baritone recital singer who commissioned, if you will, this whole series. And the AIDS Quilt Songbook was originally performed in New York at Lincoln Center about 2 years ago. And Will had gotten this. Will was sick at the time. He's since passed away. And he got the idea of getting a bunch of different contemporary classical composers each to write a song for baritone voice and piano, presumably, using a contemporary text on AIDS. He was very emphatic about that. He did not want settings of Walt Whitman or Rilke or anything like that. And I had known of this project, and I tracked him down through an opera singer friend of mine. I called him up, and I said, Will, you know, I'd like to come, I'd like to get involved in this. And Will was very kind of brusque. He said, oh, we couldn't possibly, we're full up, and you know, maybe in next year if we do it again. And I said, well, Will, you know, I'm HIV positive myself. So, you know, although I'm asymptomatic, you know, I'd rather not wait till next year. So Will said, oh, well, that's a different story. Why don't you come over? And so I went to his house and we started talking, and he played me a few of the songs that had already been slated for this song cycle. And I was very impressed with the level of the work and also the kind of people that he was able to get to participate in this thing, some major composers. And he gave me a book of poetry called Poets for Life. And he said, maybe you'll find something in here. And anyway, I just sort of left Will's house, and the whole thing kind of came together in a matter of just a few days. It was a very fast process. And I've never written a, quote, art song before, nor have I written any real poetry before. But I felt like I had a point of view in this song, talking about, you know, two people who are both ill, and, you know, one kind of always expected to be the last one to go, and now he finds himself being the first one to go.
Did you write it from that perspective, because that's the position the singer was in who commissioned the song?
Not really. I mean, it's not it's not autobiographical, nor is it about Will. It's just I thought it was an interesting point of view because, it's also about, if anything, perhaps it's autobiographical in that as I've gotten older, I've grown to understand that love or, real love is not necessarily having somebody there for you, but being able to be there for somebody else. And this person who's singing this song has great regret that they're not going to be able to be there for this other person the way that they wanted to be. So I felt like, it's a more, noble point of view or what have you. And it just was something that I wanted to express, and it just sort of came out that way.
Now, you said you wrote this for a baritone named William Parker, uh-huh. But the singer I believe we're going to hear is William Sharp.
That's correct. Will got three of his friends who are probably Will and these other three gentlemen, Sanford Sylvan, William Sharp, and Kurt Ullman, are probably the finest young American baritone recital singers by far. And when we performed the concert, Will, first of all, physically was not up to singing 16 songs or 17 songs, and he generously kind of divided them up so that each singer sang four or five songs. And when we recorded it, each singer recorded the songs that he had sung in the concert.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear your song. It's called Blues for an Imaginary Valentine. My guest, Fred Hirsch, at the piano. William Sharp is the baritone. The music and words written by Fred Hirsch.
Myself, but for you, whom I leave behind, and for you who must face death.
A song by my guest, Fred Hirsch, who's featured at the piano. William Sharp was the baritone. When you acknowledged that you were HIV positive, were you worried that it would have any adverse effects on you professionally? And were you surprised by the reaction you actually got?
That's a tough one to answer. I think at this point, as a pianist, as an artist, as a musician, as a composer, I figure people like me or they don't at this point. I've made a lot of records. I've performed a lot in a lot of situations. I figure at this point people are going to like me or they're not going to like me. I'm not coming out about my HIV status in any exploitive way or to get any kind of pity or sympathy from anybody. But I feel like just on a personal level, the energy that's been created by my coming out of the AIDS closet and of the closet in general has had a really beneficial effect on me as an artist, as a performer. I feel like this kind of music, jazz music, and the kind of music that I write, it demands being comfortable with yourself. And if you're hiding something, it's very difficult to have to be comfortable with yourself musically and personally. So I just felt like the benefits would far outweigh whatever little consequences there might be or people who are either AIDS paranoid or homophobic. I can't control that in the world anyway.
How do you feel that your music was inhibited when you were in the closet either as a gay person or as someone HIV positive?
Well, when I first came to New York in 77, after I got out of music school, I began sort of living a double life. I had kind of, I would go around and in the gay world, and then I had kind of the jazz world, and they didn't seem to ever coincide. And it got to the point where I was getting paranoid that some of the band leaders that I was working at the time would find out about my personal life. So I just kept everything very, very quiet. I'll recount a story. I was playing with Stan Getz in 1982, and he had come over to the house for a rehearsal. And I'd been living with a lover for about 2 years at that time, and I'd been very kind of quiet about it. And I remember Stan walking down my hallway. I have a loft and a long hallway. He was walking down this hallway, and I ran into the bathroom, and I hid my lover's toothbrush. Because I didn't want him to see that there were two toothbrushes, and he might think, well, you know. I mean, it was totally nuts, really. It was crazy. You know, I was just paranoid and nuts. And after he left, I thought, who cares? You know, I mean, so what? So I began to talk more openly about it. Now, the jazz world has certainly a reputation as kind of a macho, womanizing, you know, all that kind of stuff. And to be honest, I've had to, you know, for a long time, sit and listen to, you know, things that I would not probably find as humorous as some of the people who are telling them.
My guest is pianist Fred Hirsch. His new solo album is called Fred Hirsch at Maybeck. His song Blues for an Imaginary Valentine is on the album The AIDS Quilt Songbook. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. When you were thinking of coming out, were you more afraid of the reaction of musicians of an older generation that you were playing with, musicians of, say, Stan Getz's generation, and musicians who were considered giants, but who were older than you were, and who, for generational reasons, might mm-hmm. not have been as comfortable with the idea?
Yes, at first I would definitely say so. But it's interesting, and this is another, you know, one of these ironies, that some of the people of that generation who I have now been open about, who I've been open with, they've been very supportive, interested, interesting. I was traveling with Toots Thielemans, the harmonica player, in Europe, and it was about the second night of a 2-week tour. And there was the trio and Toots, and the other two members of the band, they certainly knew what was going on with me in terms of being gay. And after dinner, everybody, I don't know, it was just one of these things where everybody kind of pulled out their wallets and started showing pictures of their girlfriends or wives or children, and I felt very kind of left out. And Toots, who's a very sweet guy, he looked over at me and said, you know, I really hope you meet a young lady that you can be happy with. I'm so happy with my wife and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I knew it was motivated by a very, you know, sincere desire for my well-being. Well, as it happened the next day, Toots and I were on a train sharing a compartment in the train. And I said, you know, Toots, I really appreciate what you said to me last night about, you know, helping that I find a young lady to share my life with. And it's a lovely thought. Just change the sex. Just say to yourself that you hope I find a nice young man or a nice man. And he just sort of looked at me and just looked for a second. And he said, well, that'll take some getting used to, but okay, you know. And now when I talk to him, he always asks, hey, are you seeing somebody? Or if I've been seeing somebody, we've been invited as a couple to his home. You know, and I feel like it was a risk. But if you want to have any kind of intimate relationship with anybody, you know what your sexual orientation is, or whether or not you have a potentially fatal illness, is a prerequisite to any kind of intimacy. You can't say, "Oh, such and such is a good friend of mine," but they don't know anything about you. So the reason that I do talk about it is to hopefully be more real and more interesting and more interested.
I want to get back to ballads again, and I guess I'm wondering if you found yourself gravitating any more toward ballads when you found out that you were HIV positive, if there was a level of either sadness or nostalgia or something like that that you found in ballads that just related to you emotionally.
I think on some level maybe, but I think mostly the emphasis on the last couple of albums has been on the Blues for Imaginary Valentine and the Tango notwithstanding. I think the emphasis for me has been on just playing. The record of standards I did last year, the record of jazz composers that'll be coming out in May, both with my trio. The emphasis has just been on playing. I found people that I'm very, very happy playing with. I found a trio that I'm just very pleased with. And so I just wanted to get the focus back on just playing, on not, you know, fancy material, nothing pretentious. Just kind of back to basics, back to the kind of tunes that I started to that I played when I kind of first started playing jazz, you know, 20 years ago. And in a way, it's not. I'm trying not to be morbid about this and seeing this as some summation of my life's work or anything. It's just kind of what I'm enjoying doing. It's just going in the studio and just playing some tunes, and I feel like as a player, I'm at the level where I think that in itself would be perceived as some sort of statement.
Fred Hirsch's new album, Live at Maybeck, is on Concord Jazz. The AIDS Quilt Songbook is on Harmonium Mundi Nightingale. His new trio album will be released next month on Chesky. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.